When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
You're listening to the voices behind Women's Cricket Chat. That's Georgie and Alex. Coming up on today's podcast.
Hello and welcome back to Women's Cricket Chat with me, Georgie and Alex. And today I'm absolutely delighted. We are joined by the OG MJ, the real MJ, and she is the smooth criminal of cricket. We're joined by the wonderful former Australian cricketer, now broadcaster extraordinaire, Mel Jones. Mel, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us and getting up early.
Well, I almost feel like I now have to moonwalk across the screen with the smooth criminal introduction, but I will hold off on that.
Oh, be good though, wouldn't
sheer it? Embarrassment, more than anything else.
If I was clever enough, I'd fit in more Michael Jackson songs, but I'm going to run out soon, so I think I'll just have to cut it off there.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah, there's too much of a good thing. So you're coming off the back of obviously a very busy time. We've just had the WBBL, if we're just going to timestamp this one, and then we're coming into, we've got BBL going on, and we were just chatting, you're off to India soon. Very exciting stuff. We'll come to all that soon. But we want to talk about you. So just to kick things off, where did it all start for you?
Oh, where did it start? That's a really good question. I think from the cricket perspective, like just very typical Aussie upbringing. So when Christmas holidays come around, school holidays, you typically, you know, what we did, we went to my grandparents' place, which is a small country town called Rutherglen in Victoria. Big backyard, six male cousins. You just played backyard cricket. Time the sun came up to it went down and you got called in for dinner kind of thing. So we would have these fantastic little competitions. Me with a Trinidadian background from my dad's side was always the West Indies. My six male cousins were always Australia. I never got to bat. It was a long, long summer, but I absolutely loved it.
Did you have to do that thing? When I played with my older brother, I never got to bat or bowl. I just fielded and I felt like I was included in that way.
No, I definitely got to bowl a lot because I think they're a bit fair weather, you know, get a bit hot, get over 40 and they were just like, nah, I'll just bat sort of thing. So it's probably why I started off as a bowler when I first came through pathways in state cricket, probably because it's just the amount of overs bowled. But yeah, look, it was just fun. You make up your own rules. It was the best part of backyard cricket. You know, you hit Pars Chrysanthemums, automatic out. You hit Nan's Chooks, you're out for the summer. You got the spiky bush on the cover drive. You get it in there, you can keep running because it, you know, cuts your arms as you're trying to get the ball back and all those sorts of things. Automatic wicket keeper. Nan's Sheets are on the clothesline. You had to run in diagonally like Malcolm Marshall. If it was just socks and jocks, you know, you could come in nice and straight like Michael Holding. So it was all those kinds of things that just made summers really, really fun.
And it's really interesting that you mentioned previously when you were playing with your siblings and cousins that some of them would be like West Indies, you'd be Australia. This is a question I've asked a few guests who do kind of have like dual nationality. Did you always plan on playing for Australia or did it ever come into your mind that you would play for another country or was it always going to be Australia?
Well, funnily enough, when I was growing up, I didn't know there was an Australian women's cricket team. So there was no thought about playing cricket for the Australian women's side. I did stupidly think that I was going to play for the Australian men's team because that's all I could see kind of thing. So, you know, you just think, well, I'm going to be the first girl to, you know, kick Alan Border out of the middle order kind of thing, you know, that kind of random, fanciful sort of dreamland kind of space. But when I was, yeah, definitely I followed the West Indies, you know, I look like them. There was a point of connection. I've mentioned this on a few podcasts, you know, Melbourne and Australia was quite a white country growing up in the 70s and 80s kind of thing. So you sort of gravitate to what you look like. And my dad knew a lot of the West Indian guys, so Malcolm Marshall and Joel Garner. So they'd organise tickets when they toured and the like. So I'd go along and watch from that perspective. And dad loved his cricket. Mum, not a sports person at all. My biggest fan and probably one of the main reasons why I sort of got to where I am, but never really understood cricket. Wasn't, you know, you got to go for Australia or anything along those lines. So I don't think I realised it was an Australian women's team probably until I got to, I would have been middle high school kind of thing when something sort of, you know, when I started playing club cricket probably. And even then I didn't even think I'd do that. So.
Yeah. And you say that it was sort of around high school time. So how did that journey come from just playing in the backyard to then sort of realizing that there was this possibility of you being able to go further with it? Were you pursuing other sports or something at the time? Or was it just like, right, actually, yeah, it is there. I'm going to chase it. I don't want to.
Yeah. Javelin. I played all sports. Yeah, so I was in athletics. I did a lot of athletics, sort of probably jack of all trades, master of none. I was probably getting shunted a bit more towards heptathlon kind of thing. Played basketball. I tried trampolining. I did gymnastics. I did a whole range of sports. Back to my mum, taking me everywhere. Saying after I'd say, "Oh, I'm trying this, mum," and she'd go, "Okay, dear, off we go." But I think it was just a bit of fate. I went to a high school that had a geography teacher who loved his cricket. And we happened to have a couple of other girls that loved it as well. So he got a team together. As it all sort of transpire, John Hanscom is the dad of Peter Hanscom, who played cricket for Australia. So, and I became a sports agent way down the track. Our sports management company actually managed Pete for a while as well. So it was this kind of full loop circle with my geography teacher getting me into cricket and then me helping Pete down the track as well. So he and our PE teacher were fantastic. And so they got a schoolgirls team together, and then they realised when a couple of us, you know, were pretty keen, they went out and sourced out some local women's cricket clubs, and we went down and played there. So if I didn't go to Elwood High and went to another high school, I could be playing basketball or athletics or something completely different, not trampolining. I kept missing the trampoline. That was never going to be pretty.
And having played all those sports, do you think it kind of helped you become a better cricketer, a better batter? Because it's something we asked Bryony Smith, because she played a lot of tennis and badminton, and she said it's really helped with her stroke making and stuff like that. So I'm just curious to know if playing other sports is beneficial to cricketers.
100%. Not just cricketers, any sports person, I think. I look at, particularly, and I mentioned, I joke about trampolining, but the gymnastics side of things I think helped so much with my fielding and just sort of body awareness, being able to, you know, dive and protect your body in different sort of roles and things like that, whether it's in a circle or out of circle kind of stuff. I definitely helped think there. I think for basketball, sort of just that tactical and reading play kind of thing. I know it doesn't happen as much in cricket, but your mind's just working in a different kind of headspace and peripheral space sort of thing. So I think, yeah, every sport you can pretty much pick up. I think you could make a touch point back to the sport that you eventually end up doing. Athletics is great just for, you know, your basic fundamental motor skills of, you know, running, jumping, hopping, skipping, all those sorts of things. So yeah, so I'm very big person in encouraging, you know, young kids to play as many sports as possible for as long as possible as well, just to give them that broad scope.
So basically, you and Susie Bates together could start the cricketers basketball team, and actually get some really good.
Yeah, I never said I was good at basketball. I just said I played it. So it was, you know,
it's one step further than most of us. People tell me to play it because I'm tall, and I'm like, well, maybe.
Yeah. But, I'd go away for our university team. I think they just like having me around, so they'd spread the rumor that at university Australian champs that I was the American import, and I'd just sit on the bench because I was never needed because we had a really good basketball team. Until one day when there was an injury, a couple of people fouled out, and the coach is looking at me going, you know, shit, we're going to have to put her on the court. And within the space of about 3 minutes, I'd fouled twice, travelled and scored for the opposition. So they went, get off.
You know what? As debuts go, it's one to remember. And that slides us nicely into cricket international debut. So it was pretty cool that when you got to make an international debut, obviously that's incredible, being called up for that one. I think I read somewhere that you said you were stuffing your face with a prawn cocktail when your name was read out as part of the Australian
good squad. Research.
I mean, we all love a prawn cocktail, but what was it like to get that call up and then to have to sort of chug down the prawn cocktail and
chug down the... Yeah, we just finished a state final. So it was back in the day, Victoria versus New South Wales, which was the arch enemies. And we played, it was state finals had just gone to one-day cricket. So we used to play two-day cricket finals. So we're at the SCG, which was a highlight in itself kind of thing, to be able to play on the SCG. And then we came in for the end of tournament function, which also included then the announcement of the Australian women's team. And so you're in this beautiful old members pavilion in the bar area, which is sort of tiered, and it's absolutely gorgeous. So I'm just soaking it all in, you know, sitting at the back with mates, as mentioned, chugging into a prawn cocktail. I'm like, these are all right. And I didn't even hear it because I just wasn't even really paying attention. You know, you hear a couple of names, you know, Vic players, and like, yeah, they got back in. And of course, then it was this, no, you're not. You're trying to, you know, make a fool of me and go up where I haven't been announced kind of thing. So there's a little bit of argy-bargy with the prawn cocktail with my teammates going, no, you actually have made it kind of thing. So it was, yeah, shocked to say the least, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, then you back that one up with a century on debut. Can you remember it? Or because sometimes we speak to people and they say their international debut was kind of just a blur and they sort of have to look back on it to remember what it was like. What was that like for you and then to score a century on debut?
Yeah, test debut, I definitely remember. Like, so I'd already played. So it was 97, I got picked. We had a series against Pakistan at home. Then we went to the 97 World Cup in India. So I'd played a series of ODI games for Australia already. But to come into a test series, three test series, Ashes tour overseas in England. So, you know, we had to take 6 weeks off work kind of thing and beg, plead and borrow money and leave and do all that sort of stuff. But, you know, I mentioned about, you know, growing up playing backyard cricket, it was test cricket that we all sort of grew up on. So that was the thing for us, you know, to be able to, you know, that morning pack your vest with the Australian coat of arms on it and pack your baggy green and your whites and know that you're going to get tested in all sorts of manners of form kind of thing. And I remember we were, which is surprising for the Australian team at the time, we were in strife. We'd lost three reasonably early wickets, Kightley, Clark and Rolton, three handy wickets at that.
Name clangers, doing.
Yeah. Just bang, bang, bang. Yeah. Exactly. So you sort of walk out and you're like, geez, you played 2 day cricket, but you'd never played 4 day cricket. And you're like, you're just trying to get your head around as much of it as you can. And I think I'd love to say it was a green seamer and it was doing a hell of a lot, but it was an absolute road. We were down at Guildford in Surrey. And I can remember being not out overnight. And it was one of those things where you sort of say to yourself, you only get one chance to make a good first impression. And that was in my head is that, you know, just don't stuff it up, Jones, kind of thing. So it was great. Branded with Joanne Broadbent for, you know, a big partnership and sort of got us back in the game for a bit.
And yeah, you just mentioned there about having to take time off to play cricket. We have now moved to professionalisation and obviously it's a shame it wasn't there and around when you were playing, but how pleasing is it for you to kind of see where it was in 97 and to now see girls and up and coming cricketers be able to have that opportunity where, you know, they don't necessarily have to worry about having a part-time job to go alongside playing cricket?
Oh, it's brilliant. Like I pinch myself daily pretty much just in what I'm doing for work, what I'm seeing within just the women's sports space more broadly, but specifically for women's cricket. And, you know, people often ask me, would you change it? And I wouldn't, because I think when I look back at that cohort of women that I played with, they've all now got massive touch points in the game because they have an understanding of where this game's come from. And making sure that people are cognizant of that and recognise that the history, I think it's really, really important that we don't forget that. And so, you know, you've got your Belinda Clarks who worked for Cricket Australia for so long, but has now got her own leadership playground company. Lisa Kightley has coached both the Australian women's cricket team and the English women's cricket team. Julie Price is in there. Chris Matthews has just resigned as the CEO of the WACA in Western Australia. So these women that we all sort of played with have stayed within the game and now have found professional working careers within the game. And I think that's been a real big part of helping that transition period of going from purely amateur to full-time professional. So, yeah, super, super proud of the sport and the women in and around it that have sort of, you know, left their mark in it as well.
And on those kind of tours, obviously tours nowadays are very different to what tours were like when you were going on them. I spoke to Pricey a bit about this before and she said actually they were such good fun sometimes. You're almost put up in like houses with people and you're basically just like staying with your mates.
Billeted,
like,
yeah.
Like in a hotel, everything done for you. What was that like? Because it sounds actually like really good fun.
It was like, I just thinking about a few moments then, you know, and it just brings a smile to your face because it was almost like everyone has a gap year or what have you, or they travel for a little bit and you're backpacking. It was like that, but in a professional sporting sense kind of thing. So yeah, we the island section of that Ashes tour, we got billeted out. So we were known as the Dog House, Karen Rolton, Lisa Kylie, Julia Price and myself, because the house had a dog, you know. Then there was the cat house and they had a cat and all that sort of stuff. So you just, you know, and you'd arrive at the airport and it was like you were back in high school on a school camp, and you're sort of standing there waiting to go, you know, which family's ours kind of thing. It was, you know, and at breakfast time, because you didn't get paid, you'd get a per diem. But the per diems wouldn't cover all the things that you needed, just functionality stuff like laundry and things. So at breakfast, you'd have breakfast and then you'd take out your little napkin and you'd put a couple of rolls and a couple of little jam things in, and you'd sort of wrap them up a little bit so you could have a bit of lunch on the road so that you could use a bit of your money then for laundry, because, you know, £3 a pair of knickers to wash, it added up pretty quickly, and your per diems were absolutely done and dusted. I can remember my first actual injury for Australia was on an Indian tour, and I went to the physio. I went, I think I'm having a heart attack. I don't know what's going on. What was going on? And I realized that I'd strained a pec muscle because I was scrubbing my laundry so much that I'd, you know, strained something. So it was completely, but it was so much fun. You know, it was planes, trains and automobiles in India, overnight trains. You don't know if the train's leaving on time or not. It was just absolute chaos and bedlam, but it was so, so much fun. And I actually feel a little bit for the players these days, which is going to sound weird when they're five-star hotel and business class flights, but you miss a little bit of those stories that you have with teammates, of the randomness of how did we get out of that situation kind of thing.
I mean, that is like crazy to think about, like in terms of modern day, because obviously, like George said, you just stay in a hotel and everything's basically done for you. But I kind of wanted to know, throughout your career, you've been able to travel to so many amazing places. What have been some of the highlights of some of the places you've been to?
Oh, that's a long, long list. That's probably the podcast part B. You mentioned Pricey, Julia Price, best mates. And so, because by the time we started touring for Australia, the tour would be paid for itself. So you didn't have to worry about most of the time, flights and all that sort of stuff. But because we're away, Pricey and I were like, well, we've got to have flights paid for. We're off and going after that. So there was the on-tour experiences. We toured India in 1994 with the Australian youth team, and then followed it up in 97. And India was a completely different place, like every country is, you know, everything sort of, you know, moves on sort of thing. But that was super, super fun going through India back in the 90s. We had a World Cup in South Africa in 2005, so I spent a bit of time post that traveling around. I did a bit of development work in South Africa as well, and through, we went, sort of took ourselves up through Kenya and Zimbabwe. So you sort of, whenever you're there, you reach out and you say to the Women's Cricket Association, look, we're here if you want us to run a clinic or do anything for you, you know, we'd be more than happy to. So you then start to meet all these people involved in the development of the game in different countries. So that was probably the highlights, is being able to just sort of get away from the actual professional side of playing the sport and people involved in that space, and actually getting out and meeting the people that are purely passionate and love the game as much as you do from a grassroots level.
And those are the highlights sort of off the field. I mean, we could go on for hours with one thing and another, but we'll swipe it back into the cricket side thing. What would you say have been the highlight, were the highlights of your playing career? I mean, it's quite hard to pick between sort of World Cups, Ashes and just all of those kind of things. What would you say was the highlight of your playing?
I'd probably have to put it into a couple little different compartments, because I think usually when I say this first one, people sort of go, you can't be serious because it's club cricket. But for me, like when we were playing, you'd have a couple of weeks off to go and play for Australia, and that was about it. You might have one or two camps maybe, so you weren't in and around the Australian women's team set up a lot. Most of the time you spent with your club side and state side. That's, you know, so you knew these people intimately. You know, they're mates, your teammates, you knew when they're going through exams, you know, they're going through breakups, if they, da, 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 all those sorts of things. And I remember when I joined EMP, as at a Maribyrnong Park Women's Cricket Club, they'd gone through this lull. They were known as the social club. They didn't win anything. They had a great time, which is fantastic. You got to balance it all out. But it was when we came through and won the flag for Premier Women's Cricket here in Melbourne for the first time in 18 years. Just the celebration of everyone involved in the club, from, you know, the scorers to parents to the old girls who've been at the club since day dot. And that definitely sticks out in my mind when I think about sort of, you know, cricketing moments that, you know, I sort of think that's where all the hard work kind of pays off. So you can sort of, so that's definitely one of them. Yeah, World Cups, like Eden Gardens for the 97 World Cup final was just next level. You know, you got Well, it was debatable about the amount of people there. It sounded like about 130,000 people. The guy who was going for the world record of most amount of women participating in a World Cup final, he said 80. I don't know. Probably 70-odd thousand people. But they were all women dressed in the most beautiful coloured saris. Like, so visually, it was stunning. Like, I can remember standing out in the middle and just looking around. And they were, the movement, it was like a wave of just technicolour kind of thing. And of course, they all knew exactly where the game was at. And thankfully, it was New Zealand were playing, not India, because I think we would have just lost our marbles then. And you could hear and see the state of the game by just almost watching the crowd getting involved in our game kind of thing. So yeah, so that certainly stands out as well.
Did you ever think, oh my gosh, there's so much colour, how am I going to be able to see the ball? Because I often think that, you know, when they see the ball in the crowd, well, actually, you can.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, played at the G with no one there, and the MCG sort of got greyish seats. So, yeah. You know, if the white ball gets a bit older and you're sort of like, ooh, or the Gabba's not a great ground seeing ground when there's no one in there, because it's sort of got blue, maroon and yellow kind of seats, that sort of hotchpotch kind of stuff. It was funny enough, that never sprung to mind for some reason. I know that the noise was ridiculous. Like, you just couldn't hear the person, you know, if I'm at point, there was at the cover, it was just not a chance of actually hearing anything. So if Clarkie's yelling at you to change position, but the guy bust all the women in, set the record, and then we're coming home past Eden Gardens about 1 o'clock in the morning from a function, and there's still thousands of people around the ground, and we're like, what's going on? And he forgot he had to bust them home, so there was still all these poor women trying to figure out how on earth they were going to get home. And I'm sure you've heard this antidote, but it was Julian Goswami was at that game as one of the boundary riders. I never really knew that women's cricket existed, and there she is watching our final and then getting inspired to go on and do all her greatness.
Yeah, well, she is and has been an incredible member of the women's cricket community. And like, even when I was watching that the Mitali Raj film, was that earlier this year? Last year now? God, I don't even know what year it is anymore. Like, her role in that. And then I remember watching, were you at her retirement game at Lords, that final one?
No, I missed it, unfortunately, yeah.
I mean, it was quite a funny moment when she came out under that massive guard of honour to bat, and obviously it was out, like, next ball, and back she went again. So, not quite the way her started and ended in. So, but I think it's funny all the same, because nothing ever goes to script, does it? But next in your script, obviously, when you decided to retire, was that a difficult decision? And did you know what kind of stuff you wanted to go into after you stopped playing?
Well, technically, I've never really retired from the Australian team. I got dropped, so, you know, I'm still here if they need me, is all I'm saying.
You know, right? Go and eat some prawn cocktail, or maybe you'll suddenly see your name again.
That's it. So, yeah, 2005 World Cup was my last Aussie game, and then I played state cricket for a number of years, and then you sort of know. I'd actually retired from playing for Victoria, which is my state club, state side, for all my career. And then David Boone randomly rang me up and asked if I'd play for Tassie, and they were just starting back their state side. And it's sort of hard to say no to David Boone. So that's when Julia Price and I went down and played. I played one season down there, and then just knew the body wasn't holding up the way I would like it to, but also time commitment when you're still working full time and you're trying to progress a career in something else. So it was sort of that balance of, can I give everything that I want to be able to give to state cricket? So it was a reasonably easy decision for me to say, no, that's it for me.
And just quickly on that, like you say, you haven't technically retired from the Australian women's national team, but you have retired from state cricket. Right, how much are you aware of the kind of legacy you've now left, and like how much you are sort of a role model for this newer generation? Perhaps you are that role model that perhaps you didn't have growing up.
Yeah, it's I think there's a Susie O'Neill who was an Olympic swimmer for Australia for many years. She was Madam Butterfly. She was phenomenal, absolutely brilliant swimmer. She always said, you don't get a choice to be a role model. You just get a choice to be a good one or a bad one. And that sort of stayed with me, in the sense of just making sure that those little moments where you see someone at a cricket club or down the street or something along those lines, that just, I think time is an important thing. I think it's such a precious thing, but it doesn't take much to take some time out of your day just to say hello or to have a conversation with someone. I mean, I know you've got to put boundaries in place for yourself, because it is a precious thing as well, and you've got to make sure that you have enough for, you know, family and friends and yourself and doing all those sorts of things. So I don't think you're conscious of it too much. Well, we certainly weren't, because it wasn't the big sort of element of television and broadcast around when we were playing. You just sort of get in there and do you do. I think it's probably a lot more evident these days for the players now, and even for myself being in the media, that you know, you're everywhere a lot of the time because of TV. So there's I put a lot of importance on it and relevance to it, and I think it's just important that, you know, I think first and foremost you want people to see that you're absolutely enjoying your work and your career, and yeah, that there's a pathway, I guess, for anyone coming into the game, whether it doesn't matter their background, their gender or what have you, that there's a space for them in cricket, which is nice.
Yeah, and I wanted to touch on that one. So obviously you are prominent in the media, having been a player as well, but how important is it for you as a person of colour that you are there and you are that role model? You know, we say it so often, that see it to be it. But the reason we say it so often is because it's true. And how important is that for you to show, you know, there is that space, like the likes of you and Ebony and Michael Holding, you know, all spoken out really openly about, you know, we've all seen the racism in cricket and how that space is there for people of colour as well. And it's just as important that they can see that too.
Yeah, it is. And as much as it was pretty tough, you know, a couple of years ago, post the George Floyd position, and we were sort of in COVID times as well. So Melbourne probably had one of the worst lockdown laws going around at that stage. It was really, really quite a tough time, because what it does when something like that goes so big, and we're just talking about, you know, protecting your time, is that it hits your energy levels a lot, because people always go to those people. You mentioned to the people that probably had to be the face of it for such a long time in Ebs and Mikey. And that's draining, and it can be actually quite detrimental to mental health, to physical health and all those sorts of things. So I think there was a big lesson learned in just trying to protect yourself and set boundaries. But you know, you have to have those conversations as well to ensure that people feel as if they can actually come to you and ask the tough questions or the awkward question or those sort of, you know, those ones where they go, I don't know who else to ask kind of thing. And I think that's where we all sort of said, you know, this is a moment in time. So we've got this opportunity of speaking to people about our lives within cricket, how tough it's been at certain stages, where can we improve, all those sorts of things. And then ideally, the more you can have those conversations, then it allows you to create hopefully a nice cohort of allies that aren't people of colour that can step in as well. And I think that's probably the most important thing, that it's a shared journey. It's not just up to us all the time to do all the talking on behalf of every person of colour within the sport of cricket. The more that people can actually understand and empathise with that pathway, then hopefully it makes it a lot easier as well for everybody to just enjoy it.
And I guess it's about that education side of it as well. You know, like you say, don't just go to the people of colour just to ask them. That everyone needs to learn and be able to talk openly about it, because that's when you do break down these barriers, rather than just someone almost being like, I know that they're going to phone me up at this point. You know, you, even as a woman, sometimes you're like, I know someone's going to phone me up because I'm a woman, because they're talking about sex. Yeah. Look, my phone's ringing. I bet you're talking about sexism again. And you almost, like, can we just talk about the cricket rather than the fact that
I'm a woman?
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, it's something that we still don't have right. Like the ICEC report comes out 12 months ago, and it was pretty, I think it was shocking to some, but it's, you know, to people who have been in the game for so long, who have, you know, who have seen the game from basically an outsider looking, trying to get in, it wasn't shocking. That's just the reality of where the sport's currently at, kind of thing. So, but what the report does, it just opens up some more eyes and allows people, if they want to step into that space, to actually ask, how can we be better? To try and start to shift those things. So, you know, moves like having Ebs on the board of the ECB now is fantastic, because here's this report, but, you know, the board members, having not lived it, literally lived it, makes it really hard for them to make it quite a tangible thing. Whereas, you know, if you've got someone like Ebs there, again, needs to protect time and energy and, you know, her own space a bit. But if you've got someone there, it then opens up the eyes to the people who are making the decisions, basically, so that you can sort of try and shift things.
Yeah, it's something I really do kind of identify with, because it's always like I don't have a conscience of crisis, but then, like you say, it's about asking those awkward questions. And I find sometimes that I can't identify with the sports team because there's no one that really looks like me. So I find it kind of like hard to, mm-hmm. I don't know how to describe it, but it's just hard sometimes to kind of equate in my mind. Yeah, we're trying to fight for equality and stuff like that, but then when you can't really see it, it's hard to envision, sort of thing.
Yeah, look, it's how do I put this one? So the amount of times I've had people come up to me and say cricket or Australia or England isn't racist, and typically it's coming from a white person, you know, because that's their lived experience, because they're not racist. And so that's probably the trickiest one to try and manage and navigate through a little bit, is to try and just shift that starting point of the conversation, because it's a defensive one to say, well, I'm not racist, so the sport's not racist, and I don't want my sport to be racist because I love the sport, so it's not. And so then you have to unpack all that first and foremost before you can actually start to get into just, you know, that sort of open conversation. So if I could say anything to people, particularly people, white people, coming in and wanting to speak to people of colour about it, don't start with a defensive, this is how I see it, because the conversation pretty much isn't about you to begin with. It's about the people of colour within sport. So the starting point of the conversation, and this is just my suggestion and where I think it should come from, is how do you find our sport? How can we be better within the sport of cricket? And leave it as an open question.
With that one, it's like when people say, you know, I'm not sexist, I have a wife and a daughter. And you're like, well, that's not really the way to start it. There's been quite a lot of that in the media in England in the last few days. certain men making Twitter even more of a cesspit than it already was, mainly in football. There's been a lot of that. It's not been a very nice place for women in football this weekend. But, you know, it's just a small man talking small things, and that's what he felt like he would do with his weekend while other people were enjoying the sport itself. Fabulous. Yeah, so we talked about how you haven't actually technically retired from cricket, so, you know, we're going to see you in, you're actually going to India to play in the test match, did you know? You, Phoebe Litchfield, you're in, you know, opposite ends of the age spectrum, but it doesn't matter. Age is just a number and you're in. But when you did stop playing cricket, you didn't just go straight into commentary, did you? There's been quite a few roles along the way. So can we just have a quick rundown of what happened between the cricket career and commentary, and how you then found your way into commentary and what we know you to do now?
So my dad, although he worked for Hackney Housing in London for most of his career, started off in teaching like his mum did. My mum was a teacher, so I was surrounded by teachers, and I mentioned before my PE teacher at high school being so supportive. So in my headspace was I was always going to become a PE teacher. So I went through university, did all that, taught for a grand old time of 1 year, I think it was, while I was still playing for Australia at the time. Left that, got, and then realised that what I loved about the teaching sort of side of things was the development of people. So once I sort of played cricket for Australia, sort of then thought to myself, well, I actually would really, really like to go on the coaching pathway. So that's where I was sort of trying to put my all my eggs in one basket kind of thing. So I joined Cricket Victoria with the hope of then getting through into the high performance program. I sort of got into game development for many a year. I'm thinking I'm not getting where I needed to be. So transitioned out of that. Worked with Red Dust Role Models, which is a health promotion charity that works with remote Indigenous kids. Worked with them for a little bit, and then a good mate of mine set up her own business back in the day that was a sports agency, but for female athletes. So started doing like a day, 2 days a week with her. We sort of, because we understood the playing side of things, we just needed a bit of assistance with the commercial side. And eventually what happened was the company that now manages me bought out Majestic Sports and took all the athletes across. And so I ended up working at Australia's biggest talent sports agency for a number of years. So sort of when I left and did commentary full time, that's where I was working. So I had to make the decision between continuing on sort of as a female version of Jerry Maguire, but without the money, because there's no money in women's sport at the time. Sort of, you know, balancing that and going full time into giving sort of freelance commentary a bit of a shot. So that was back in the end of 2017, made the decision to go full time into commentary.
So my brain heard Majestic and I automatically thought of the wine warehouse, and I was like, oh, a cool place to work. And then I was like, Georgie, you're an idiot. I mean, it wouldn't be a bad place to be sponsored by Majestic Wine. Let's get them involved. But no, we're sensible humans. So how did you find going into commentary when you first started out? Were you thrown to the deep end? Can you remember your first stint, how you felt, what it was like having, you know, your earpiece, your people doing this, that and the other all going on at the same time? Or did you just think, actually, I feel pretty good here, I found my next thing?
Yeah, to be completely honest, I can hardly remember the mechanics of the actual day. All I can remember was I'd been dropped from the Aussie side. So they were actually up there on an Ashes tour, and I was working with Surrey Cricket at the time. And it was when Sky Sport and the ECB just started televising women's cricket. So they had, I think in the contract was they had to do one international game per year. And so they needed an Australian voice and someone who knew the players, and they knew I was over there. So they came and asked if I wanted to do it. And I just said no. I said, why would I want to commentate on a game that I want to be playing in? I thought it would be the worst experience ever. And then, of course, you go, well, you know, you don't know what you're doing, all those sorts of things come in your head. And then they said, and I'd like to say it was me getting out of my comfort zone and, you know, challenging myself and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But they said they're going to pay me 300 quid. And I said, you tell me where, when and what to wear. Thank you. So I then, because I just wanted to rub it into the players. All, like, collectively, I was earning more for that day than both teams combined, kind of thing. So I thought, 300 quid, this is great. A little bit of spending money, can travel a little bit. And the day itself, I hated, because it was, the game wasn't a great game. Men's or women's cricket, you always might not have a great game. But it was more the issue around the guys that were commentating on it. Just felt like they just didn't want to be there. It was like it was a punishment to be, you know, coming down doing women's cricket, you know. So all straight away, as soon as you sort of got there, it was just like that sort of negative tone all the time. And so then I went into overdrive, trying to go over the top, and there was some awful pieces of play. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, it was just horrendous, you know, just trying to pump things up all the time. And I can remember finishing it going, oh, well, that's it, you know, it's not going to happen again kind of thing. I was hoping to get back in the Australian team, not going to be back over in England. But pretty much, I think it was 2001. I think I did a game a year, whether it was for Sky or for Channel 9, because they were starting to do some women's cricket. So it wasn't until 2009 World Cup in Australia when the ICC took over things that they had a dedicated broadcast team. I think we did 8 games from North Sydney Oval in Sydney. And then that's when there happened to be a few more games, but I was still working full time. So like I said, it took, what was that, 2017, 16 years of doing bits and bobs of games here, there and everywhere before it was full time work.
And you just mentioned there, it took 16 years of hard graft and work to get to where you are now. And you are one of the most recognisable voices of commentary to date now. For those budding commentators, what advice would you give them for those starting out?
Oh, that's a good question, because you can go a number of different ways here, isn't it? I think the beauty of starting out these days is that there is so much cricket content to be covered. So what I would say is don't go too big too early. The beauty of when I was sort of coming through, I can remember doing a 50-over game up in Mackay and Toowoomba. So it was the Australian men's A team playing India A and South Africa A. And I was the only commentator. So I was doing days of 100 overs by myself. And it was horrendous in a way, because you're like absolutely burnt by about the 20th over. But what it allowed you to do, because people just knew it was you, they'd you know, you could just grab anyone for an interview. You could sort of just practice things a little bit. It was, I think, getting yourselves in and starting at base level with whether it's club cricket or, you know, little live stream games, do all that, understand the mechanics of commentary and the disciplines of it and all those sorts of things, which you can ask other people about, but just get in there and get, find your own sort of rhythm of commentary. It allows you to sort of work on, you know, your light and shade and highs and lows and all that sort of stuff without getting too nervous that, you know, a million people are going to hear you and absolutely slate you on social media when you get off air kind of thing. So I would say, yeah, get your feet dirty with, you know, sort of almost the grunge kind of part of cricket commentary. Don't think you're going to go straight to the top, because I think once you get in there, you can get sort of shaped a little bit how other people want you. You got to find your own commentary style, I think. And you can do that on so many different ways, whether it's, you know, radio or TV or live stream.
And I know you've already mentioned as a player, you've got to experience so many amazing things. And as a commentator as well, what have been some of the best matches, in your opinion, that you've commentated on?
Oh, yeah. There's been a few matches, I can tell you that. Look, to be honest, I would say probably a couple of the great matches, again, are probably matches that, you know, there might have only been a handful of people watching, whether it was a Blast game. I've loved doing the Blast, or, you know, WBBL game that was in Maui in Victoria kind of thing. So it's more for me, you know, games that certainly spring to mind. I've been fortunate enough to call a lot of the Australian women's cricket teams sort of World Cup moments. And they're the most nerve-wracking ever, because you know that
it's going to be whatever you say is going to be around for as long as people sort of listen to highlights of women's cricket kind of thing. And you want to do the team and all the players and the support staff justice of all the hard work that goes into creating that one very, very special moment. One of the ones that stands out for me, though, is the Ashes, Women's Ashes Test at Manuka a couple of years ago. And it was particularly the last hour of play where it was just chaos. Like Meg Lanning as a captain who was so in control of things because it was Test match cricket and they hadn't played a lot and just trying to find a way. It was the perfect example of sport finding a solution to an issue on a sporting field that they had never faced before. And so then all of a sudden you've got Annabelle Sutherland coming around the wicket and bumping the England team, and you've got Sophia Dunkley new into the game, you know, trying to hook and pull and do all these sorts of things. But in the commentary box, we had Isha Guha, who, bless her, is still, I feel as if she still feels as if she's the 12th for the team. Like she loves England, you know. And so she's like pulling her hair out, you know. On air, she is professional, and she, you know, off air, she's like, ah. And then we had Alex Blackwell next to us, who was 9 months pregnant and ready. Edie was about ready to come into this wonderful world. And I'm thinking to myself, we could have another moment that I'll be calling something more than just an Ashes win, loss or tie or draw.
And you suddenly become a midwife. Oh, God.
And it was just, I look back on that and it was just, you know, and that's where you sort of go, this is the shift in cricket, isn't it? I mean, Richie Benno would never have been in a commentary box with a woman who was about to give birth. You know, you're like, ah. And you're just sitting across going, two legends of the game and Alex Blackwell and Isha Guha now in the commentary box, absolutely nailing the call of this magnificent test match, but with all this other chaos going on around it, which is a typical female chaos kind of piece with a pregnant woman. It was just, yeah, it was brilliant. That's where you sort of go, this is where you love the sport, isn't it? That it's changed so much.
Oh my gosh, what a story that would have been, though, if she actually did give birth at test match. Thank God she didn't, because, I mean, maybe you would have found another career, you know. I'm actually going to by cricket, midwifery is the call for me now. Mel the midwife. Lovely. You can keep your call the midwife. Instead of call the midwife, we've got midwife on the call. There you go. And obviously that was one of the big highlights for you, but we've seen quite a lot of change in the women's game. What was it like for you to be part of that first WPL this year? And how big was that in terms of the women's game? You've been around, obviously you saw the start of the WBBL as well. So how much have you seen the game grow and how important was that? And what was it like to be part of? It looked mad.
Yeah, it's, what's the way to describe sort of the, it's organised chaos in a way sometimes when you get to, you know, IPL sort of Women's Premier League, because
I also feel like there's always a lot of cake. That's the kind of image I got. People were always eating cake and shoving it in each other's faces.
This is it. I think because of the enormity, well, one of the country, people-wise, but just the enormity of cricket within the country and the money that they have to be able to really invest once they've decided to do it, they're in there. You know, you're walking past buildings on Marine Drive where they've got projections, hologram projections up on the building about the Women's Premier League, and you're just looking at it just going, and there's thousands stopping on the drive to, you know, to look up at it sort of thing. And yet that's they're the moments where you sort of go, you know, the BCCI in India has the capability of just, and which they have done through the Women's Premier League, fast forwarding the projection of the sport so quickly. You know, if the Gujarat Giants team sold for more than what the Mumbai Indians men's team sold for in year one of the IPL. So you sort of look at that and you think, okay, this is where the game is now going. And it, for me, it being involved in a lot of sort of women's sport touch points around the world, is that it was, you know, it's people in America going, hang on a minute. We thought, you know, we're Angel City and we've got all these magnificent teams spending millions of dollars, and there's another sport and it's women's cricket, you know, and that's where you sort of start to see other countries and leagues and industry sort of sitting up and taking note that the game has this. It was a moment in time. It has shifted quite a way forward. And I don't think we'll probably see it a lot. I mean, we think about it in terms of the players and contracts on the field, but for me, it's more than that. It's about the sporting industry. And where they invest, you know, the commercial dollars, the media rights, that piece there is the game-changing piece for the Women's Premier League.
And I guess we've seen so much women's franchise cricket grow all over the world, like the 100, say what people like about it, what it's done for women's cricket has been amazing. Obviously, the WBBL started it all. We've got the CPL, and then you sort of see it filtering down. You know, we've got so many different regional qualifiers now. The likes of Vanuatu coming through that one. I know you went out and saw some of that. And then there's the Africa one going on at the moment, you know, the likes of Rwanda and what they did at the Under-19 World Cup. So for you, having been part of the women's game for so long, what's it like to see countries like that coming up through the ranks and getting their chance to show what they can do too?
Yeah, it's probably, for me, the most exciting phase. And not just exciting, but the most important as well, because everyone who loves sport, you watch sport because of the theatre, but because of the competition and the unknown element of who's going to win. Now, if we have Australia, England and India just constantly going around a loop, playing off in semi-finals and World Cups and da-da-da-da, you know, for those people that follow those teams, that's great. But even for me as a fan, you know, an Australian supporter, is that I just don't want to see that all the time, because I think it just becomes quite stale. You want, and this is the beauty, I was lucky enough to go to the FIFA Women's World Cup at here in Australia, and, you know, to see the USA and the likes of Germany kicked out early, yet the competitive nature of the sports and, you know, people being absolutely enthralled, people who didn't like football watching it just going, this is amazing. That's what you want for cricket. And you want that different style of play coming through. So there's, like I mentioned about the test match, it's that, how do you find a way on the field? And that's what you love about sport. So you want to see a style of Rwanda, which I don't even know what their style is. You know, is it a little bit of, you know, the way in which England play, a little bit of the way in India play, you know, but you want to see that come through, and you've got the flair of the West Indies, or, you know, the competitive nature of Australia and all those sorts of things. You want to see as many different styles of countries coming through and seeing them on the sporting field together. So, yeah. So for me, more countries, I would be investing so much more into those countries so that we come to a World Cup and any one of the 10 teams, 12 teams, 16 teams, 20 teams, because you want to keep increasing that, can actually win it. That's your utopia that we're looking for.
And I mean, you talked about the theatre and the dramaticism of cricket. I think we can all agree this summer's Ashes series was, you know, one for the books. Obviously, ended up being a drawn series. England somehow beating Australia in both white ball series, which was... No, I don't think anybody expected that. Like, what were your thoughts on the Ashes summer, and just where do you see teams, not just England, but teams in general, perhaps challenging Australia a little bit more?
Yeah, magnificent Ashes. I was fortunate enough to work across both the men's and the women's in that summer. And if I see another couple of months like that ever in my commentary or even just fan watching phase, you know, I'd be a very, very happy person. It's gonna be tough to sort of beat that combination. For the women's, it started perfectly, because it started with a 5-day test match. It started with giving curators the opportunity of creating a pitch that would break up and allow spinners to come into the game. And I think that was absolutely fantastic. We saw the pace of Filer and the likes at the start, spin, you saw some quality batting. So there was a nice competition between bat and ball all the way through. So the Ashes for the women started superbly well. Crowds as well, I think that kick-started things. Trent Bridge was absolutely brilliant. And then it got into, you know, it was almost the highlight for me was watching the different types of crowds at the grounds. So sold out to the Oval, Lords, and then at Edgbaston. And just, not in that order, but Edgbaston, yeah. Just the different types of the way in which they were watching. You know, Edgbaston was probably a little bit more your cricket crowd off the back of the Commonwealth Games, and they knew what was going on. And so you could sort of feel the tempo of the game, they were in it, da, 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 da. Then you get to Lords and the crowd clapped when Heather Knight won the coin toss. I'm like, who claps a coin toss? You know, but they, because they just didn't know, you know, what the etiquette was, but they just wanted to be nice. So they were there. And then the Oval, there was this constant murmur because they were eventers. So they're all chatting. And then something would happen and it would be a delay. What happened? Oh, okay, that's good. Yeah, and off we go. So it was absolutely brilliant just seeing all these different people coming in and experiencing women's cricket and thoroughly, you're leaving the ground, walking out with them, and they've had a ball. They've had just the best day. And I think a lot of that is off the back of the 100 and just sort of creating that sort of new fandom piece. And a lot is off what the England women's cricket team, the Aussie women's cricket team has been able to do on the field as well, which they know they've got to entertain and be world-class athletes, and they're doing that well as well.
Yeah, it was relentless. It was exhausting. I thought you were going to say you'd be happy if you saw that much cricket. I think I see that much cricket, not even that close. I'm going to have very grey hair very soon, or very little hair and no nails, because at times it was just exhausting and relentless. And I actually think I can see in the mirror now, I do have grey hairs that I have to sort of hide under my ponytail, and I've not hit 30 yet. So pray for me. Pray for me. Anyway, for you, obviously, you were involved in both sides in both men's and women's Ashes, and it is, you know, you're on the road so much. How do you sort of wind down, and is it quite hard sometimes? You just think, oh God, I am exhausted. Sometimes I just want to go home, put my slippers on and watch Home and Away.
I'll just stop you there and say, no, it definitely would not be Home and Away. And not if we even go to that one. It is, you've sort of got to, you got to look ahead a little bit. You got to sort of, you know, if I come over for the stint with Sky for 2 months, you sort of, you got your spreadsheet of games. So you need to be able to manage time in between, even to the point of really trying to figure out what's the best way of getting to and from games, knowing the complexity sometimes it can be in any country. But, you know, for England, if it's heat wave comes in or there's train strikes, or, you know, am I better trying to drive to Manchester, which could take 6 hours, which means I'm driving and I don't have prep time. So I try the train. But if the train gets delayed, at least if it's delayed, I can just sit there and keep doing my prep and just look out the window. Who else is driving? Can I get a lift with that person? Do I want to drive back straight after the game at 11 o'clock at night and drive for 3 hours? Is that a bit dangerous? But then I wake up in my own bed the next morning. So it's all those sorts of things that you're just trying to get your head around, just to buy back time, I think, a little bit more. And you've just got to be really strong, and I'm not great at it, in not over preparing and utilizing some of that time. Your prep time should be not just about preparing for the game and players and all that sort of stuff, but it should be about making sure that you're physically capable and well and got a certain level of energy to bring to the game and doing all that sort of stuff as well. So blocking off time that is just downtime, whether it's, you know, that you can go for a walk, get a massage, do whatever it is that you sort of like doing that gets you into that space.
And I saw in your, I was had a scroll through the Instagram, as I always like to do on people's before we chat to them. And I saw a thing once, and you were saying you were wearing a hat that said it's okay not to be okay, and someone came up to talk to you about that. How important is it to be open about mental health and things that can be a struggle? And especially, you know, when you're expected to be on telly and be this vibrant person talking about sport enthusiastically all the time, how do you manage that? And how important is it to be open about that for you?
Yeah, vitally important. And it's an interesting one, because we talked about it before in terms of racism in the game and people coming to me all the time to find out, you know, to have the conversations. And you want to have a wonderful cohort of allies to be able to protect you a little bit from the time and energy, but to have a broad group of people to be able to speak about it. And so from the mental health perspective, that's my place to be a strong ally. I am very, very thankful that personally I've never had any mental health issues, but I have very close family friends that have, and I see their daily struggles at times, and it can be exceptionally tough. And so for me, it's an opportunity to utilize my platform and capabilities to be able to talk about it from a, hopefully from a strong supporter and, you know, someone who's there for them to try and, you know, elevate the issues, have just, you know, respectful conversations about it and sort of break down the stigma in and around it as well. I think that's probably one of the most important things. But that moment when the woman came up, I was on the phone to my mum having a coffee and getting, you know, I was in England at the time, and she came up and she just typed on her phone, "I like what your hat says." So she didn't want me to get off the phone from the conversation with my mum. And I said, "Hang on a minute, mum." And I quickly spoke to her, and she was having a really, really tough day. And you can, having been in and around people who've sort of been in that space, you could sort of sense just how dark a place she was in the moment. And I mean, we joke about this in Australia with people that know me, you know, I'm not a hugger by any stretch of the imagination. And I just said to her, I said, "Look, do you need a hug?" And she just said, "Yes." So here we are, two strangers. We gave each other a hug. Mum's listening to the whole conversation at this stage. Mum knows when to pipe down. And I just said, you just hang in there. The tide will turn and you'll come out of it. And she rode off on a bike and, oh, I'll never see her again, kind of thing. But you sort of know that hopefully, like I said, you know, you're going to try and be an ally and step into these situations sometimes.
I find that also situations like that, the most important thing is to have the people around you. There's quite a lot of good, fun characters sort of in the commentary boxes here, there and everywhere. How much do you enjoy sort of when you get to come over to England and it's like the gang's back together? What's that like? And what's it like being part of, you know, Sky, or you join up with Ali Mitchell, you join up with Isha, you see Ebony and you're like, right, gang's all here, let's go.
Yeah. Oh, look, I've probably mentioned it far too many times, but I do. I pinch myself daily on the life that I lead and the job that I have and the people around me, kind of thing. So to come over for those couple of months a year with Sky, who are a fantastic broadcaster to work with, is fantastic, because you're not just catching up with work colleagues, you're catching up with, you know, really good mates. And so to do that, to have good mates in and around your work life. And not constantly, because, you know, last year, Ebbs and Aisha probably saw twice each kind of thing, you know, bar a quick pass in the mini box kind of thing. So it can get quite manic, but you know they're close and they're close by sort of thing. It is a hoot. And yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest challenges, is particularly when you're on air with them, not to get too familiar and not, you know, not that you'd ever say something that you're going to regret, or, you know, what happens on tour stays on tour kind of thing. But I'm very mindful of, you know, that people are listening in, and it shouldn't just be people listening into our little personal conversations is about a game, but that they're very, very close friends. And particularly on, we've just talked about the schedule and how manic it can be. It's so nice to know that, you know, post a game that you can sit down at dinner and just dump whatever's going on in your life and know that you're in a really safe space and you can, yeah, recharge that way very quickly for the next day, which is nice.
Final one from me. Having witnessed so much great cricket, either playing or commentating, where do you see, or where do you hope that the women's game will be in the next couple of years?
Yeah, I've mentioned a little bit, touched on it a bit before. My concern would be about the gap between probably, you know, the sort of top three, four nations getting bigger and not pulling the other nations along with us. I'm very strong in my beliefs that as much as, you know, you invest in your own country to be the very best they can be, it's no point if you're not playing quality competition all the time. So I'd be very, very fervent in my approach to say, let's have a collective, collaborative approach to where we want the women's game to go. And I think that means that we need to look across and down a little bit more with all the other nations playing and uplift them as much as we possibly can.
Well, I think that sort of rounds it all up quite nice. It's been absolutely amazing to have you with us, Mel. Thank you so much. I know you're a very busy human and you've had to listen to us as well for the last hour and a bit. To round it up, it has been an absolute thriller to come back to the Michael Jackson, and we really are very grateful for you for coming on. It's been amazing to hear about everything. We love watching you, catching up. I sometimes see you in passing in a commentary box. We wave and we go. Maybe one day we'll all actually get to sit down in the same chat. Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been amazing to hear about everything that got you into cricket, what you do, and I can't wait to see what comes next for the world of women's cricket.
Thank you so much, guys. And look, can I flip it around a little bit here? This is the best part about my job is working with amazing people, but amazing people are doing fantastic work as well. So to you guys, just keep going. It's absolutely brilliant to have so many different voices in the game who see things differently, who report on it differently, because that brings more and more new fans into the game as well. So you're doing superb work. Keep going.
And to all our listeners, if you want to keep up to date with everything that we're doing, you can follow us on Twitter and TikTok at WCricketChat. On Instagram at Women's Cricket Chat. And if you want to give us a like on Facebook, we are Women's Cricket Chat. If you'd like to give our personal Twitters a follow, then it's at GeorgiaHeath27 and I'm at Alex Jane Pereira. This has been Women's Cricket Chat. Tune in next time.
Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.